Welcome to the World of Women Create podcast series, where we bring you the magical and innovative worlds of artisans and makers from the pages of our magazines, Where Women Create and What Women Create, along with special guests who are entrepreneurs and experts in their fields. We love to share great conversation with extraordinary women, women you may be very familiar with and others you may not know. My name is Jennifer Blott, and I am the editor-in-chief of Women Create. It is my pleasure to welcome you, our listeners, and all of our guests as we explore the ups and downs, challenges and triumphs, exhilaration and immense joy of living a creative life. A creative life is a life that's rarely stagnant and always leading us down surprising paths. Thank you for being part of our creative world, the world of Women Create. Welcome. I am here today with Beth Beck, the founder and CEO of Mill House in McKinney, Texas. Beth is a PhD social scientist, not a rocket scientist, as most people ask when learning she retired from NASA. She is a nonlinear, disruptive thinker with expertise in creativity through collaborative practice. Beth spent most of her federal career in Washington, D.C., and moved back to Texas to retire in 2018. Her story of founding two nonprofits in her retirement years is our Art of Business story in the summer issue of Where Women Create. And we are thrilled to be here with her today. Hi, Beth. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to share our story.
I feel like you have multiple stories within your one Art of Business story. I'm really curious about your career with NASA, but I think right now I want to start. I know in your story, you mentioned envisioning your retirement years, gardening and writing and being creative, and you are running two nonprofits. How did it happen? Tell me sort of the timeline on this.
I grew up in Texas, lived 30 years in DC working for NASA, and always thought I'd move back to Austin until my sister moved into this area in North Texas, and I fell in love with McKinney. So we have an aging mother. So in coming back to town to set up my new homestead and help my mother out, and I really bought a home with a massive, what I call retirement yard, that could take all of my time every day to work to get 100-year-old weeds out of the yard and to build a garden. So that was my grand plan. There's a flour mill in McKinney and a cotton mill in McKinney. And I'd driven by several of them with my sister. And I said, oh my gosh, it'd be so cool to have an artist colony in these old buildings where you could have artists who live, work, and sell their work all in one place. So I kind of had this artist colony thing in my head for a while, and seeing these facilities, it seemed like a perfect place, but that was just how cool if someone else did that. So one day my sister is a photographer at the cotton mill. So I was going to go with her as her assistant, photography assistant, to hold her lights for a shoot she had. And then we went to the cotton mill. The owner of the cotton mill, Terry Casey, pulled up in his truck and met him. And I told him my grand plan of 30 seconds of how his building could be this art colony. And he said, I have bigger plans than that. So from that was really the inside. I called it the divine appointment day. So I met Terry. He found out I was from NASA. He found out my background was innovation and creativity. So he and I started meeting about how the cotton mill could be part of an innovation hub to bring in companies to McKinney to plant themselves with the cotton mill. So that's really how it started, innocently. Like he owns a building, government makes no sense to him. So that was perfect. We're a perfect pairing where I would go and figure out, what is the city doing? How is it growing? How can the cotton mill fit in? So when I was doing a listening tour, met the city manager, he invited me to a committee he'd started called the Culture of Innovation Committee. It was Beth and the guys, which basically is my life at NASA. And we spent 3 months talking about the definition of innovation, which felt like being back in the federal government. So I raised my hand and said, I'll write the charter. When I wrote the charter for what does it take to get innovators to the city, I realized women need this more than men. So that really was the inciting incident beyond meeting Terry and then kind of having this light bulb moment of, women need this. Men have access to capital and to facilities and to talent. Women just don't. in talking to Terry, I came back and we were talking about that. And so he, a week or so later, took me to an area of the cotton mill that I had never been in and gave me the keys to this 16,000 square foot space and said, make your dream for women artists and entrepreneurs a deal.
And was the idea always to be a nonprofit, or were you thinking it would be a for-profit at one point?
So we started out as one organization, as just Mill House, and we were a 501c3, which is a non-tax-exempt nonprofit. We did plan to do that. IRS had us split up because we are a membership-based. So we had membership-based in it, which is a 501c6 as far as IRS code, which has the studios and artists. So they had us split up. So we could, because I started Mill House McKinney is a .com, just how I set it up. Mm-hmm. Mill House Foundation is a .org. We could in the future, if we wanted to, have one be a for-profit and one be a nonprofit. We're certainly not at that point. We're 6 years into it and still figuring this out. It's an interesting process of you know, learning what works in business.
The seeds were planted in 2018. You opened your doors in 2019. And how did you get those first women to become a part of it and basically come in and have studio space with you?
Well, we started socializing the concept. I was able to connect through all these connections that Terry started, was able to connect with influencers in the city. And so we had a kickoff meeting to just socialize the concept of if we had this place for women. Nobody got it. A place for women made no sense. I can just the comments in my head that still float make me giggle, the things that people said to me at the time. We called them summer sizzles, where we would once a week have women come to a local restaurant and we would again have the conversations and talk about what it could be and what people would do. So people who were, you know, the voices in the city knew about it. I felt like I was losing myself because every time we had a meeting, people would tell me what it should be. Here's what, if you did this, I can't tell you the number of people told me if I made it a STEM center, I could get plenty of money. I came from NASA. I get it. It's not what we were. And I wasn't willing to change who we had meant to be. It's a different clientele than STEM, just to get money. So finally, I said, you know, if you build it, they will come. I knew if we open our doors, women would walk in and go, I totally get it. And talking about it, I learned that through many years at NASA. There are some people that are great with a blank piece of paper. I'm one of those people. Majority of other people need a plan. They need to see it. They need something they can chew on and tear apart. But to just give them a blank and say, picture this, picture the house I'm going to build on this hill that you have never seen. People just can't do that. So we just opened the doors. Thankfully, we got 5 founding members who were leaders in the city who signed on. And they had signed on and pledged, and that if they had come through with the pledges, we would have had 6 months of operating expenses. So that gave us legitimacy. But for me, that gave my partners, that gave them legitimacy. I knew, because this is what I do, I knew it would work, but it gave us a good start. And I appreciate that they understood the concept. And it just takes one or two, you know, to actually say, great idea. I love it.
How about your own sort of connection to creativity? Are you an artist? Why did you want to found this nonprofit for creative, innovative women?
This is one of those stories. So I started out at NASA. I was able to study photography. So I studied photography, non-traditional photography at the Corcoran School of Art and printmaking out of a fluke. That I got NASA paid for me to do that. So I have had my own one artist show at the Torpedo Factory in Alexandria, Virginia. I was really involved in their art program. I'm a dabbler, and I'm a writer. I do creative writing. So I am a creative. People ask me all the time, which studio is yours? Like the whole thing. If we just let your brains expand in a little bit, just try something new, it expands so many opportunities. So what I love about this new life I have is, yes, I work long hours, but I also get to take all these classes. I take pastel classes and printmaking and watercolor, and I don't have to like them all, but everything that I learn in one or the other expands my brain a little bit and allows me to see the world differently. So that's what I love about having these creatives. We have, by placing photographers next to writers, next to designers, next to artists of different kinds. The way women create best is in this collaborative environment. And when we feel welcome, there's no talking head telling us what we can't do, but women around us telling us what we can do or try it. It's okay to try. I mean, I had experience doing that, except with innovators, not so much creatives. Mm-hmm. So this is this new world of letting, for me to be able, I love to create and I love to learn something that I've never learned or tried, and to be able to do that with other women and to tell them it's okay. It's okay for you to try something. You might be an expert in this. It's okay for you to try something else because it may make you more of an expert in what you're doing because you've expanded your perspective.
So when you opened, you had 4 studios. Today, you have 32 studios.
We do.
So I want to know, if I was with you today, what would I see? What's happening there today? What's happening in that space? And what could I, if I had moved to town, how could I take part in Millhouse?
When we started, it was just a warehouse space, and it hadn't been used since the 1960s. And had all the bird poop on the floor and the animals were in here. And so it, but it was beautiful. Even though it was boarded up, we could see how pretty it could be. So now he's built it out so that we have our 14,000 square feet, which we've got 4 different suites. We've got a photography suite with 2 photography studios, which are collaborative. Everything we have is collaborative. We've got a workshop space. Everything's on a Google Calendar. You just sign up on the Google Calendar, get your space. And so everything's kind of open to everyone else except their private studios. We have a collaboration space, which slash co-working, and 2 gallery studios. But then the rest of the kind of the main hallway that we're in, we have a coffee shop, which is brand new, and I'm spending way too much money on their coffee. We've got a milliner in a studio. We've got a recording studio kind of next to us. And every time I turn the music on, they have me turn it off. And there's a really nice pottery studio. So there's a lot going on now. And then we also host festivals. We have this year, we have 15 festivals that we're running. So we're stretched pretty thin. So there's a lot to do. So when you come to Millhouse, you can go take a pot of it. You don't have to just be at Millhouse. You can take a pottery class down the hall or work here, take a class here, teach a class. It's all about women. We want women to make money. So part of this is, as members, they can teach classes, which brings revenue in. They can, especially for photographers, they can come use our photography studios instead of having to buy all the equipment, the backdrops and the props. They can use, all they have to do is bring their camera and the clients. So it, we kind of keep the cost of entry low so that they can have a margin of return that's higher than they would if they had to go, you know, start over without Millhouse. So you, there's a lot for you to do. You can take classes or kind of hang out, read a book, drink a glass of wine.
And some of the artists have retail components, right? You can buy their creations, right?
Yes. All of the art is available for sale. So what we also have a common area. We do exhibits every quarter. We change out our exhibits, which is our Millhouse artists. We have a boutique shop where they put their products in, and that changes quarterly. So anything in the common areas, Millhouse will check them out. If it's in their studios, the way our deal with them is if whatever they sell out of their studios, they keep 100%. If we need to go in, open the doors, send it through our system, we keep 20% and they keep 80%. And so we only do that if they say yes, and everyone said yes, because why would you lose a sale?
And do they have to, if they're actually coming into work and create, are there specific hours? Do they have the key? Like, how does this work for them with actually using the space as a studio?
So we have the social space, the co-working space is 9 to 5. They do not have keys. So anyone who is, it's called basic membership. They come in and I call that your laptop membership. You're going to bring in your computer and work. For the people with studios, they have keys. So it's 24/7. They have access. And they only, because we have 4 different suites, for each suite, they have a key to their suite. And then they have a key to the front door. They have a key to their suite and then a key to their own door. Some of them don't even lock their studio doors because there's a key to the suite, so it doesn't matter. We also have, there's a workshop that's in, a workshop room is in one suite, so the people who have a key to that suite get to use that for classes. So we try to keep it where they feel comfortable that no one's coming in on the weekends into their space without, you know, their knowledge. So it's all about making women feel welcome and safe. But then that Monday through Friday, we're here. So we keep it all open and, you know, we keep track of everyone coming through and make them feel welcome.
So as you know, we have two magazines, Where Women Create and What Women Create. And I love that you have focused through your story on how women create and how women create and innovate differently than men. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about this and how you figured out that women create differently, how this realization came about in your life.
I'm a nonlinear thinker, and my career, I was surrounded by linear thinkers. So I drove them crazy. And I just don't, as I learned working with linear thinkers who tend to be men, but there are women who are linear thinkers too. They have to follow a path. They have to go from A to B to C to D. And that is the path forward. And they will innovate in the margins of 5%. So an engineer will do, and they'll do all kinds of things in the 5% range. Well, I'm like a 360 person, so I can flip all around. And learning through my career, we did innovation testings. I did innovation programs, and people, especially when linear thinkers didn't know what to do, they would turn to me, even though I made them crazy, they would turn to me and say, go figure it out. And I would. So as we did, what kind of brought me to this place where I am now, I, as a woman in the workplace at NASA, I bristled at being deemed the woman in the workplace. I really had trouble my entire career. I would not, the irony of where I am now, people who knew me then laugh that I'm doing a women's thing, because I wanted to be the best person in the job, not the best woman in the job. And it bothered me that there were subcategories. So I really kind of bristled at that. But my light bulb moment, I was running a program. It was called Space Apps Challenge. And we brought in, it was using NASA's open data. And we worked with citizens around the world to hack on our data. So it was a hackathon. And I went up, I had taken over the program. And so I had gone up to Toronto to a Space Apps event. They had students in one room, and they had all the adults in this big museum in Toronto. It was 98% men in the hackathon. The 2%, which may have been women, were like volunteers and helpers. They were not on the teams. And this was a creative challenge. We had challenges and we had awards and all of that. And so I went up, they took me up to the room with the students. They were middle school students. And so the boys would be, they were head down on an iPad doing something. And the girls, middle school girls, were little honeybees, and they were running around from, they were just gobbling up the technology. And so one girl would go to one table and go, look at this. And they would all flock to her and they would all gobble up that. And then someone would spin off. And I'm watching this going, what happened? These girls are so eager to consume this technology. And then you go downstairs and it's all men. What happened? So that was my light bulb of where did this happen? Well, that was too big a question to ask, because my job at NASA was not to figure out why girls weren't interested in technology. But when I kind of boiled down the question, because my job was to try to get citizens engaged with open data, because we have storehouses of data from all NASA's missions since the beginning of time. So how do we get citizens to use our data in creative ways? So that was my job. So we really did a research project looking at how do we get women, because I couldn't figure out why girls weren't interested, but how would we get women engaged and what would that look like? So I did a year research project. We went to the West Coast and interviewed a lot of innovative programs, and I was ready to shut down the program because it made people angry. Like, why was I asking about women? And I thought, I get it. Mm-hmm. I was like that too. I didn't want to be the woman. But when we, and I asked my boss, I said, I think I'm done. I don't want to do it. She goes, nope, keep trying. So I went to New York. We interviewed the makers groups and the data groups and women leaders in New York. And it's at the time, it was a very vibrant community. And I met with one woman who was the leader of one of the organizations. And I said, what would it take to get you to engage with NASA on like a data program? And she said, you know, men engage in their free time. Women have to make time. And the minute she said it, another light bulb went off. And I went, oh my gosh, I'm exactly the same way. I'm so stretched. I'm a single mom. I'm working crazy hours, you know, getting the kids to do all this stuff. And when would I do a NASA program except they're paying me to do it? So then I started, it gave me the right kind of set of questions of how do I get, so if women are overtaxed and constrained with time, what would it take to get them involved? And as I started asking those questions, they were the right questions to ask. Well, women need to feel welcome. They don't innovate in a toxic environment. And a lot of the organizations that were mainly male were extremely toxic in your startup. So women wanted to be able to create where someone wasn't telling them what was wrong with it. And they also wanted early access to information so they could kind of form ideas and form teams before the ratio changed that all the men showed up. And then women are perfectionists, so we don't want to try anything new unless we think we can do it well. And so in an all-male environment, you're not willing to put yourself out there because the voices will come in because you didn't do it kind of well. So we learned through this program of how do I teach women how to use data. And what I learned was women are storytellers. So we're very good at that. And so I created programs at NASA with this, we call the Women in Data Program. Again, made me giggle that I was now creating a Women in Data Program that all the federal government used. So I used to go around and teach all the other agencies how to do this. But we created an early, we had called it Data Boot Camp before our hackathons. And we invited women in and I invited them by category, like storytellers, designers, artists. I named all these things that women might see themselves in. And said, you are who we're looking for. We want you to come. And then I had a day long of educating them. What is an API? What does a data set look like? So as we would walk through, like, here's what these terms mean. And I would say to them, you don't need to know how to do this. I just don't want you to quit because you don't know what it means. Because that's what we'll do. We're perfectionists. If we walk in and go, I don't know what they're talking about. I don't belong here. I'm out of here. And so it's like, you don't have to be the expert. You're the storyteller. And the other thing I tell them is like boys, men, when they innovate to make it slicker, sharper, faster, you know, cooler. And when women innovate, when I looked, and this is my experience doing these hackathons and around the world, women care about solving a problem in their community because we just want to make it, you know, fill the potholes so we can get to work, drop the kids off at school, get to the grocery store, pick up the dry cleaning all in one time. So potholes are a big deal to us. I don't have to have the shiniest car to get across them. So I told the women, if you can tell a story on this team, and that's the only role you have, you'll have a winning team. So we just introduced these concepts. And as I did this year after year and saw women take over the data, I'm not a data person. So data shows that when women were on a team, they did better. And when women led the team, they were winners because women are really good at this. We're good at creating and we don't have our heads down. So we can multi-process, we can multitask. We see the landscape and we can see a light where men don't see because their heads are down doing the linear process. So as I kind of dug into this and worked through it, that's if we use all of those concepts for Mill House, because we're creating an environment that's welcoming for women where there's no one to tell them they don't know what they're doing. They're busy telling themselves that. So we pull ourselves out of the game before the game even begins. So that's what we try to really work in, pulling on those threads of creativity. Here's this, I see that you're drawn to pink. Let's do more pink. I see you're drawn to squares. Let's try more squares. Oh, you don't like squares. Great. Let's do triangles. It's okay to try and fail. And there's so much creativity out of failure because I failed at many things, but that's okay. It taught me don't do that or don't do it like I did it. I might do it again, just a little differently to get to that edge. So
a lot of what you're saying sounds very valuable for younger women. Do you get school-age girls coming to Mill House doing programs? Do you have an opportunity to reach a younger demographic at Mill House?
Here's what I've learned to do. So the answer, short answer is yes and no. What we can do at Mill House is what people have hearts for and have, you know, have the willingness to come in and do. So when we've had members who like to work with young girls and students, then we've had those programs. I personally can't do them all. I kind of run it. But when we have someone who has a passion and plugs in, then we can go, if you're willing to do it, we can. So we have, what I tend to find is people bring in young women for me to mentor. And that I can do. Like, I can have conversations with them. Usually it'll be, I met their parents somewhere, and they say, can you know, so-and-so come in and talk to you. I'm always happy to talk to young women and give them. And then I plug them in to people that I think that they can work with. So I can't take on their growth, but I'm really good at seeing things in other people and seeing what they may not see in themselves. Just a few conversations and I'm already going, oh my gosh, she'd be so good at XYZ. Have you thought of that? And then I can see immediately their eyes just light up, and no one's ever told them that, which is really fascinating to me. No one's told you you're good at this? Because, oh my gosh, you're good at this. Here's the other thing. We need permission for some reason in human nature, and especially women. We somehow need, I don't, but a lot of women need permission that it's okay for them to try something new. So we don't have programs for young women, no, because it's just not, we don't have, if we had a staff, we could do, there's so much stuff we could do if we could pay a really big team, but right now we're still in the growth and trying to make it day by day. But yeah, I would love to, when I get a chance to talk to groups, yes.
And so the women who have studios at Millhouse, are most of them full-time artists? Are these side gigs that they have a day job? Are they of all different ages, all different sort of, you know, phases of their careers?
Absolutely. All of the above. Okay. And that's what I love about it. We have full-time artists, and we have quite experienced legendary artists that are here, and we have brand new artists. So we've really found, we love to graduate our members, and they can start at zero and go to full capacity, or they can start at 30% and move to 50%. So it really is kind of a move the needle, but we have some women who only come in at night because they work during the day. I don't see them as often. So it's, you know, I get to see them on weekends sometimes, and then we have people who are just here every day, you know, making it work. What's really fascinating is some of our artists are incredible businesswomen, and then we encourage them to teach classes on that. We teach a lot of classes on social media, you know, how to increase your market, because we have speakers every week, but usually the topic is someone said, I don't know how to do X, and they'll go, oh, okay, let's figure that out. So we had our lunch bunch speaker this week. Someone said, can you help us with email marketing? And we said, yes, we can, because we've got two of our members are really good at that. And so we approached that very day, she's got a studio here, and we said, would you do your email marketing talk again? So we tried to encourage classes and speakers on topics that women feel like there's a hole that they don't exactly know how to do. But it is really great that we have so many different kinds of, like, from professional to amateurs, and it's okay. And because it's safe here, it's okay for them to be at different levels and not feel, because we discourage the comparison, you know, just because she's making $3,000 a painting doesn't mean that your $50 a painting isn't worthy, because it's, you start at $50 until you build your clientele. We work with a lot of pricing. It's like you can't expect $3,000 if no one knows who you are. But letting the different levels of disciplines and experience is, I think, the beauty of what we do at Millhouse, because we all learn from one another.
And you talk a lot about how women create, knowing how they think and how they create, and if they're nonlinear, how do you help them with the business side of it? I'm sure that some of it is not only skills-based, but it's almost a confidence. How does this sort of way of creating that women have influence their ability to get their business off the ground?
Yeah, it's a huge disconnect between the creativity and the business. And most creatives will tell you the thing they hate most is the business side of it. So we really, I have a series of talks I do called the Business 101, and I walk through, many women are people pleasers, many women are perfectionists. I'm a recovering people pleaser and a recovering perfectionist, so I know it well. And we have placing boundaries. So we talk about business boundaries. And in the business boundaries, you've got to figure out, number one, the mission of the business. You can't place a boundary about around what you're doing if you don't know what it is. And so we really work on helping them figure out what is their authentic voice, what is it they're offering. So especially with creatives, like we might have 25 photographers. So instead of having them compete with one another, it's like, what is specific about what you do? Oh, I only do babies. Okay. Well, I only do this age, or I only do natural light. I don't do studio lighting. So we work with them on identifying what's the thing that they do that makes them stand out. And especially with like painters and graphic artists, like what we want is someone to recognize your work when they see it. So if your work looks like everybody else, then what's the thing that you like to do the most, and let's do more of that. So that's part of the business side, is you have to figure out your brand identity. What is it? And so we do work on that. And there's also the brand promise, which I talk a lot about. What is the brand promise? I will offer you, I will get this thing done that you have offered to pay me for in X days. Or I will, so what is it that you were promising from your business? And then once you promise it, you deliver it. I say over and over and over and over is women are your best brand marketers for you if they've had a great experience. So if it's a product or experience or, you know, whatever you're offering with your business, you have to do what you say and say what you do, because the minute you are late on something, whatever the excuse is, then word spreads, because women will say, you don't want to work with so-and-so. She's not going to pay her bills, or she's not going to. So there's a lot of the how to do business is, what is your business? Who are you in your business? Separate yourself from your business. This is the people pleaser thing we have to work on. But then we also work on pricing.
Pricing is huge. A lot of women do not charge enough for their work.
But there's also the graduation to that, because what we kind of giggle at here, some people look at one of the experienced artists or businesswomen makes this much money, and they all of a sudden jump their prices to that. So we try to work on, you should make, and we talk about what's the formula for making your money back, but you also sometimes have to give to get. There's times where you have to give to get your name out there because you're developing clientele. And then as you get supply and demand and you've got too much work to do, then your prices can jump. And then you've got collectors coming back over and over, your prices can jump. So we really, artists do not charge enough. Absolutely. They also can't charge too much, because you've got that balance of, you've got inventory sitting there because the price is too high, but you don't want to give it away. And we also talk about, how many things do you donate per year? Because I promise you, people walk into Millhouse all the time. I've got a silent auction. I need 3 pieces from artists. So I tell them, back to boundaries, decide at the beginning of the year, how many pieces for what value will you give away? And then it's the end. So, and it's okay for you to say, after, I'm going to give away 3 for the price of whatever. Then if number 4 comes in, you can say, you know what, if you can come to me next year, be first in line. Yeah. So there are ways, we try to work on phrasing too. How can you say no and not make an enemy?
I love it. And in the way you describe yourself and your story, you know, you're nonlinear, you're disruptive, you're feisty kind of, and I love it. And some of those things seem at odds with working in government. I worked in government, and my experience was can-do people, because I had come from a newsroom and I was a can-do person, but I was in a situation where 20 people need to look at this one thing and sign off, and you need to have 20 community meetings and people who just like get it done really quickly. Government is built on the process and it taking maybe even longer than it should. So how is that for you? Because you like want to get it done, right?
Well, the thing is, I think it was the best experience for me, because I assume the answer no. Mm. I walk into anything, assume they're going to tell me no. And then I can tell you the times I spent in the lawyer's office, and I would have them take me to the law books. Like, you show me where it says that I can't do this. And then they would show me the law, and I'm saying, okay, it doesn't say that. And then they go, well, but it's precedent. Totally get it. So thankfully I worked at NASA, and I could say, why don't we set precedent? We could set precedent. How about we do that? So I worked on, number one, you find the innovators. So I knew the yes people. You've got the underground yes people. And then they're the big no people that can stand away in the way of anything. So what I would do is assume no, figure out why, which kind of no is it? Is a statutory, regulatory, policy, culture, or just personality? Culture and personality are the hardest no to change, even with statutory. You could actually get a law change before you could change somebody's opinion. But it really is kind of knowing that no is the going in. I would say, I want to try this pilot. And then they're going to assume I'm going to fail and they can't wait. And they're, you know, going, I can't wait to watch her go up in flames. And then it wouldn't be a failure. And then all of a sudden, here's the thing about human nature. We chase success. And so by creating small little successes, people would chase them and they would take credit for them. And I would let them take credit for them because I'm off to the next thing. So I think in the federal government, it taught me how to expect to work really hard to get to yes. And I watched a lot of men that I worked with who were extremely creative, and they would get bitter when their really great ideas didn't make it forward. And at first it surprised me until I realized, oh, they're assuming success and I'm assuming total resistance. And so I work at it. So I think it's really, and again, when I came here to McKinney and started facing some of the no's, sometimes I would giggle and think, I've seen worse. I was in the federal government. I've seen worse. But really, truthfully, that's why Millhouse happened, because I'm sitting in that culture of innovation committee, having to dissect the definition of innovation. I felt like I was back in the federal government. And I thought, this is like being in a State Department meeting. NASA wasn't as bad as state. And I would go to State Department meetings, go, oh my gosh, I'm going to pull my hair out. So that's why I said, I'll write the charter. I'll do it. Let's move forward. And then from that, Millhouse happened. So it's a good story that I had 33 years in the federal government.
You were supposed to be retired after all that work. And here you are, maybe even working some days longer than you did at NASA. You must be invigorated by what you're doing. You must have so much more to do in your career.
I'm a public servant. I believe in the public good. And there's a reason I work for the government, because the public good is the thing you do when there's no monetary value to it. The gap I saw in the marketplace for women, sadly, and I don't have the data to back this up. I have anecdotal data. People will pay more for art from a man than art for a woman. Human nature is that it is more valuable because a man created it. And so I look at the injustice of that and think women have so much to offer. And yeah, I'd rather be writing books. You know, I love to write. That's really was my plan. I was going to garden and write books. But I get to write a new story every day. And we get to, by pouring into these women who I'm watching them just unfold, and we're doing new things and creating new things and we're growing. And I love it. I don't love the hours. I would love to, you know, figure out how to not work 1,000 hours, but we're not in a place where we can have a huge team that I could hand things off like the old days, like, oh, just hand it to a contractor and they would do it. They hand it to me and I'll do it. So I think it's we're year six. And that's the other thing I talk to business women about, is how long are you willing to go without a salary? And like, what is your motivation for starting your business? Because a lot of people come in, they hate their jobs, they hate their boss, they want to start a business. And we've seen them, since we've been in business 6 years, we've seen them turn around and go back to the job. Because no matter how much you hate your job, you're going to love your salary. So do you love this thing that you want to create enough that you're willing to eat ramen noodles for like 4 years? What, or have a side gig or something? So there are things that now that I've lived this process on the other side, if you have a passion, and I learned this at NASA too, the things that I did, it's like people with passion, they're going to persist. And so if you have a passion for it, you're going to do it. Did I see myself doing this? No. Am I glad I'm doing it? Yes. And I really have, there are so many women that we're helping and we're infusing into them new confidence and the creativity. And I love that. I love watching the women excel and explore. And where our whole thing is, we want women to flourish. So it's not just about thriving and surviving. A lot of women are surviving. They're just making it through. So if we can give them something to be excited about and give them new lease on life just for a few hours a day, then that's worth it.
Well, and in your story, you said you love it when the women outgrow Millhouse, like they move on because, wow, you've done your job and they're going on to bigger studios or bigger businesses.
We're here to like move that needle. Our favorite stories, we had it when we first opened up our the co-working space, which was in October 2019. And so we had a woman join us in 2020 who wanted to start her interior design business. COVID hit. Well, she did design on the dime. And it was this brilliant, she shifted to this brilliant model of, you know, you're now in your home and you can't leave it. So let me work with what you've got and what little money you have. And I'm going to create a space for you that feels good since it's COVID and you're stuck here. I can tell you she had, I was sort of watching all the people come in to meet with her, you know, with 6 feet of distance and with their masks on and all that. And so she grew that. And then she outgrew us and got, in 6 months, she did so well that she got her own building in one of the neighboring little towns. And then she set up a little mini mill house where she had creatives and artists because she needed to pay for her rent while she did interior design. Well, then she outgrew that and she had to kick out all the artists. And then she created a design studio. Then she outgrew that. And now she has her own custom. Then she started remodeling. And then she has her custom design building business. She builds homes in one of our neighboring towns. So I call it startup to success in 6 months to watch her from here. So we've had her come back and talk. I mean, how cool is that? So we saw her in the beginning and championed her on. We gave her a place to be where there was no place for her to kind of meet with clients, which is what we offer, is meet with clients in a professional environment. If you meet with them at your kitchen table, they'll pay you 5 cents. If you meet with them in a professional environment, they might pay you $50. So it's moving people into this environment where the client's human nature is you are worth more in a professional environment. Same person, same product, same service, but you clearly are valuable because you're in the space. So we love to see women, and we only have so much space here. So when they need a bigger gallery, I'm sad. I'm sad when they leave, but I'm glad that they're in a place where they need a bigger space and we move someone else in. So we call it musical chairs because people move back and forth and they'll move in an open studio and then they're waiting for a private studio and it's an 8x10 and they'll move to a 10x12. And then it is musical chairs and people will come back in 6 months, go, where's so-and-so? Oh no, she's moved over here. Cause we just, women, we like to change our minds too.
Well, you've inspired me. I wish I could be there and explore the space. Well, we were fortunate to have you share your story with us in Where Women Create and on today's podcast. And thank you so much for joining us, Beth. It has been wonderful.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for telling our story. We are so excited and we're so thrilled to be part of the Where Women Create family now.
And your story's evolving. I expect a follow-up story from you in a couple of years.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us today for our World of Women Create podcast. In a world filled with endless stories, it is our mission to share the memorable personal journeys and lessons learned of the extraordinary women in our community. Their stories are stories that enlighten us, inform us, and ignite the creativity that lives in each of us. Women Create is grateful that you are part of our creative world.